Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And along with John, KC2WGB, John and Dick try to run something called the Technical Net, which meets most Sunday evenings for educational purposes. A little bit of entertainment sneaks in. An interesting week is passing us right now, meaning that the latest issue of QST Magazine, the April issue, has two very nice articles about what's happening as the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. That happened in April 1912, and so the stories of the radio operators involved with that particular operation make some pretty exciting information about the state of wireless technology and what it can do and how many lives it saved and how much better it could have been. There's also some other interesting articles about the thing we've been talking about for some time, and that is the poor man's ballon, the RF choke made out of a few coils of the coaxial cable near the antenna. There's an article there telling you how many turns, what diameter, and what kind of performance you could have out of it. There's also another nice article in the latest issue on the subject of ground reflection. Depending on what altitude your high-frequency antenna is mounted above the ground determines how much spacing there is between the real antenna above the ground and the mirror image of the one below the ground. And the mirror image one, that reflection, where does it take place? Is it 2 feet out in front of your antenna or 500 feet out in front of the antenna? And what kind of terrain is out there? Is it water, marshland, or sand, and so on? So some interesting articles along those lines. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in might be AK1NS, Dave, and yes. So do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW listening.
W2BMP, Joe, yes.
W2ZEN, Lewis, yes. Okay. Joe, W2, is that Baker, Mike, Papa? Do I have it correct, Joe?
Correct, sir.
Okay, the next one I heard was something ZE. There was a triple. Who is the ZE?
W2ZEN, Lewis, and yes.
Okay, we got you, Lou. Was the third one Jim? KD2BHY, is that who I was hearing in there, Jim?
That is correct.
And N2XGN.
US2N, Paul, with a space report to you.
Okay, very fine. So far we've got Joe, Lewis, Jim, Wes, and Paul. Anyone else to give me your call letters and name at this time? K2LIW.
K2KY2, and I'll be just listening. Joe.
Frank, no.
Okay, KYQ was a no, and the second one was a no. Was there another one in there with a yes? Give me your, anyone else with a yes, give me a call letters and name right now. Okay, we got more than enough to get going. Joe, W2, Baker, Mike, Papa, go right ahead. What would you like to talk about tonight? K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Well, Dick, first of all, I just want to say thank you for the TechNet. I've been on it for a couple of months now, and I just wanted to thank you. Extremely, you know, informative. And my question is, I'm just getting into HF, and I'd like your opinion on an indoor attic, dipole that would be multiband. I'm interested in 6 meter, 10 meter, or 12 meter. Do you have any suggestions on an attic type of antenna?
You probably know ahead of time, Joe, that when you mount the antenna in the attic, depending on what your roof is made out of, can make quite a bit of difference in the performance. I guess very few of us have what I'm looking for now, metal siding on the house, but very often you don't have, it would be very rare to have that on the roof. So a roof that's wet, depending on what it's made out of, will give you a slightly decreased performance. On a quick question first, Joe, what makes you think you must keep the antenna inside? Is the does your particular town, which is Hicksville, I don't think Hicksville has any strong restrictions on outdoor antennas. On top of that, we amateurs, most of our HF antennas are made out of wire. We know to look for wire because that's what we're very interested in. The general public does not see wire up in the air, obvious by the fact that you've got these telephone poles and wiring going down every street. They don't see those. So if you had an outdoor wire antenna, assuming you've got a tree or some other support to put it on, or even if you just run one end of it to the chimney of the house and the other end to whatever else support you've got in the yard, would be a very effective antenna. And as I said, the residents don't see wire. So before we proceed, what makes you think that you're forced to keep the antenna inside? Back to you, Joe. W2BMP, K2RIW.
And my response to that is I've been married 40 years, and I'd like to continue that.
Okay, from that I sense that your wife does sense, she does see wire, and she considers it not desirable looking. I'm a little bit disappointed by that, but because most wives don't see wire. We'll assume that yours does. Now, if you were trying to operate on 80 meters, where a full-size dipole would be 132 feet long, and unless you're a fairly rich man, I don't know if the people on Page Drive happen to have really big houses. Very few of us have got a house that's big enough to put that much antenna inside. So 80 meters means that you're not going to use an ordinary dipole. That's not a showstopper. One of the things you'll discover is that as you make a full-size half-wave dipole physically smaller by shrinking its size, by using loading coils at the base of the antenna, top hat capacitors at the top of the antenna, zigzagging the antenna back and forth in various ways, maybe putting loading coils in the middle of the wire on each side. There's various ways you can physically shrink the dipole. In fact, there's something called the isotron antenna, which is a compact structure intended for indoor use, which I believe is a version of it that works at 80 meters. So there are various ways of making the antenna physically compact enough so that it will squeeze inside of the house. Let me drop. And the good news is it can be done. The bad news is that you pay a price. Whenever you make the antenna physically smaller, the bandwidth of the antenna, the frequency range over which it works well as far as standing wave ratio is concerned, becomes more and more narrow. In theory, you can make an 80-meter dipole instead of 132 feet long. In theory, you could make it 20 feet long. If you did that, and you could definitely resonate it, you would get, under normal conditions, as long as you use quality materials and the way you shrink the antenna, you can get 98% of the performance. You can get the exact same gain on transmit, the exact same amount of effective capture area on reception. Of course, that doesn't make common sense. It's kind of hard to believe that something physically smaller will have the same area. You do enough research, I'm pretty sure you'll be able to confirm that. And one of the respected giants of radio, John Krause, W8JK, Dr. John Krause of Ohio University, now a silent key, he made that clear when he described in his book called Antennas by McGraw-Hill, what is the performance of an infinitesimal dipole, that the bandwidth can become so narrow that if you change your frequency of a transmitter by 50 kc, you've got to retune the antenna tuner. And the antenna tuner will have to work real hard as you tune very far away from center frequency of that antenna. So you can squeeze the antenna inside the house. And if you want to operate on... If you want to operate on multiple bands, the nicest way, in my opinion, and you'll get other opinions from other people, but the nicest way to operate on multiple bands is to build a fan dipole. In other words, if your favorite bands happen to be 80 meters, 40 meters, and 10 meters, for instance, there's nothing stopping you from making an 80-meter dipole, a 40-meter dipole, and a 10-meter dipole, and putting all three dipoles in parallel. Connect them all to the exact same point in the center, fan them out a little bit at the edges, and that becomes an automatic electronic switching network. The radio signal will automatically go down the right piece of wire because all of the other ones represent the wrong impedance, and the signal just won't go there. So it's an automatic switching network. You get full performance out of each one of those dipoles as if all the others are not there. As long as you've got enough area in your attic, nothing stopping you from building a fan dipole with shrinking techniques on the lower frequency bands to cover every one of those bands. Now, you are going to run into a number of problems, which I'm going to list for you right now. After I list those problems, I'm going to then throw it open to the net for other people who have built indoor antennas, by which they can tell us their experience, the good and the bad, how they got around it, how well it worked, and whatever. So I'll be asking the group for information on what they've done with indoor antennas. But when you do put the antenna inside the house, because quite a bit of the wiring of the house, in other words, the switch on the wall that turns on the light in the middle of the living room, we'll say, happens to have usually wiring that goes up the wall, across the ceiling, in the attic area, and then back down to the light bulb. So quite a bit of your wiring, in some cases, air conditioning, plumbing, there's quite a bit of electronics that's located in the attic. To have the antenna co-located with that, maybe even your telephone wiring and so on, you are by having an antenna inside the house going to be putting some rather strong signals into the 110-volt wiring, into the telephone wiring if you're using a old-fashioned wired telephone, and so on. As such, those nearby metallic structures will mean that the process by which you do the tuning of the antenna will be a couple of steps more required. In other words, when the antenna sees that local metal and other things that are in the house, it's going to change the tuning. You'll have to readjust the lens accordingly. That's not a showstopper. It's just a couple of more steps required. Another thing that will happen is that when you transmit, a stronger amount of signal will get into those pieces of wiring, which will get into the appliances, and it could give you some increased television interference, telephone interference, and so on. So you pay some prices. The outdoor antenna has a lot less of that. You can have the outdoor antenna quite a bit further away from the house wiring, quite a bit higher in the air, which will give you more performance. So those are some of the pros and cons. Now, for those who have built or used or have heard stories of indoor antennas, please give me your call letters right now by which you can tell us your experience, your knowledge, what you've heard, and so on. So anybody with some further knowledge on indoor antennas, particularly those strung into the attic of a house, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's Delta Papa Zulu.
KD2BH1.
Okay, I've heard Hal and Jim. Is there anyone else?
N2LDY.
And N2LDY, yeah. Mr. LDY, please tell me your name, sir.
Sure, the name is Don, Delta Oscar November.
Very referring Don. Okay, so when it comes to information on indoor antennas, pro, con, good, bad, whatever, we've got Hal, Jim, and Don in that order. Hal, how often have you put antennas inside the house? How many of your friends have done it? How well has it worked? K6, Delta Papa Zulu, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2LAW in the TechNet, K6DTZ, just about to go on of Arizona. Well, I've done a few installation jobs for different people that have limited situations, and they have antennas inside the rafters. First thing is the composition of the roof. The composition of the roof is wood, and you have no aluminum on the roof or copper. That's one thing. And what I did, I strung random wire underneath the open the roof. I utilized an AH4 random wire tuner with a ground counterpoise, and it tuned basically 80 through 10 meters. This used an ICOM 120 tuner, which went 160 through 10. Or about 35 feet of random wire on a resonant end with a counterpoise, you can make it fly.
If Joe wanted to read about that particular antenna, what reference would you recommend that he go to, Hal?
In fact, there's no reading reference. I had a project. I had it set up as a sky type antenna situation. So if he wants to give me a call and I can explain to him how to do it, I'd be more than happy to. As well as getting an AH4 or an AT120 type tuner, which will work beautifully.
Okay, so it sounds like Hal has done it successfully. Sounds like he has developed individual techniques for doing it. And by checking with Hal, you'll find out some further information. That's one possible approach as I see it, Joe. Jim, with all of your vast years of experience in ham radio, I'm having a little bit of fun with Jim, because I think Jim has his license now a whole 2 months, and he just recently acquired an antenna, and maybe he's going to be putting it indoors. So tell us what you know about this particular subject, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
When I first got my G5 Harvey Jr. from JD, I had this HF rig that Rich gave me, and I didn't have time to put it up at the time. Right now it's outside, held up by tape. I have nightmares of it falling down because the tape's coming loose. But I didn't have time to string it up with my dad, so I decided that I would just string it up inside and see what happens. I did not get one signal. I didn't hear anything. I just heard noise. I mean, I looked at the manual. I flipped through it. I tried everything. I just got noise. So what I have here is it's a dipole. So I just laid it up against the house, and it's a bit long. So I had to string the rest up in a tree, or my dad did. So I had to string the rest up in a tree in the neighbor's yard, but. It really helps if you put it outside, because as soon as I put it outside, I heard Brazil and North Dakota.
Jim, you did disconnect right after you said you heard Brazil and North Dakota. I wonder if you turned it over to us, or if the battery disconnected. Back to you, Jim.
I don't know what happened, but I was saying that I heard Brazil, North Dakota, California, and it really helps if you just lay it flat against the house. And as long as it's outside, if there's any way you can put it up stealthily, is that a word? If you just lay it up against the house, I mean, it's really hard to see. And I've heard, you know, a lot of signals. And if you're gonna put it in the house, I mean, the attic is the best place to put it, because I just threw it up on the upstairs floor. But that's all I know.
And one last question, Jim. When you did put it inside the house and you were not hearing signals, do you believe you had the antenna stretched in the normal out all of its length, so to speak, or was some of it coiled and you hadn't retuned? Do you have a guess as to why the performance was so poor inside the house? Back to you, Jim. And wait for the beeps like I didn't do.
There was a little bit of coiling, but I had strung it out. I think maybe it's because my house has aluminum siding. I think that might have been the problem.
That's good to know. The aluminum siding, and the fact that it was inside the house, and you were maybe not above the aluminum siding, so to speak, and that is a definite interfering factor. Okay, let's see how the guys out in Center Reach do it. Don, what's your experience, good and bad, and the experience of your friends that you know about on indoor antennas? N2LDY, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and everyone else listening in on the TechNet. This is N2LDY. I wanted to throw in the comment, when I lived out in Middle Island, I had a place out there and you couldn't have any antennas up and stuff. I had actually gotten a couple of slinkies, and you know, I fed the slinkies in the middle, and I had them stretched out across the one room up in the upper room in the house there, and it actually worked pretty well. I made a bunch of contacts. You could stretch them out further, or you know, put them in a little bit, you know, and play with the adjustment with that. I guess if you really wanted to, and you had the big long attic, you could probably even, you know, put two and two together, bring it out, you know, and have a lot, you know, because you get a lot of, there's a lot of wire in a slinky, put it that way.
Yeah, the slinky really is a continuously coiled antenna, a helical antenna, and as such, physically it can be quite a bit shorter than the normal half-wave dipole physical length. Electronically, it's quite a bit longer. It sounds like you're reasonably happy with that slinky in Middle Island. For 6 years, I used to live in Middle Island on Church Lane. So you and I have got something else there in common, Don. So, this gives you a little bit of a flavor. Jim, is it? No, sorry about that. Joe, gives you a little bit of a flavor of indoor antennas. Even if it doesn't work at first, that's not a showstopper. There's ways of analyzing what's happening. There's ways of readjusting the antenna electronically, physically. The antenna doesn't have to be a dipole-like structure. It could be a loop-like structure where you you string it around the perimeter of the attic. And there's some significant advantage of doing that. So even if you select attic, it doesn't mean you're restricted to one particular type of antenna. There are something like 5,000 kinds of antennas that you will see depicted in various ways. If you pick up a copy of the latest copy, is called Volasic. That's the author's name, Antenna Engineering Handbook. And it's got about 40 or 50 separate chapters on the various classes of antennas. So there's lots and lots of antennas. There's a zillion of them, as you can tell, Joe. And by the way, Joe, as you proceed with this project, and as you get success or failure, doesn't matter, please come back and tell us how it goes and what you see so far. Because your quest is not the only person doing it. You're not the only person doing it. You've got there's a lot of people out there who fear the antenna being detected, the landlord not being in favor of it, the neighbors not being in favor of it, and they want the antenna to be stealthy, they want it to be well hidden, and then so inside the house is one of the ways. So as you develop these techniques and make it work, please come back and let us know about it, Joe. N2.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And that's not what you're not supposed to do, is wait too long to let the machine reset. W2, BMP, K2LAW. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, I'm going to give that a shot, and we'll see what happens. Thanks to everybody, and W2BMP will be listening on the side. Thanks again, guys.
Next person on the list was Lewis. W2 Zebra Echo Night November, if I got it correctly. Go right ahead. Lou, what would you like to talk about tonight?
Hey, Dick. This is W2ZEN, formerly KB1VDB. And actually, I think you might have just answered my question, which I kind of knew the answer to, but I wanted to ask anyway. So let me reiterate it. I have a 40-20-15-10 parallel dipole that I just put up on the roof. Now, I don't have room to stretch out the 40 leg. Is there any issue with letting that run perpendicular down to the ground and fully utilizing, 20-15 and 10?
Yeah, you're falling into a trap that many of us fell into in the very beginning, Lewis, and that is all the pictures we see in the books for simple dipole-like antennas. For a horizontally polarized dipole, it's always shown as a completely straight out flat piece of wire parallel to the ground, no particular altitude above the ground, fed in the center. And we're led to believe that any major deviation from that pictorial will make the antenna crash and burn. We're led to believe that. In reality, the antenna itself is really a distributed, resonated structure. And any method you want to resonate it, by making it physically shorter, but making it electrically longer again, by adding coils, zigzagging it, bending it down on the ends, mounting it vertically, mounting it at a slant 45-degree angle, making one half of the dipole horizontal and the other half of the dipole slanted 45. You don't have to feed it exactly any of those techniques. You don't have to feed it in the center. Let me drop it. If you've got the right kind of a balun and the right kind of impedance matching structure, you can feed it 10% off-center, 50% off-center. You can feed it at the outer end. I mean, the antenna itself is a resonating structure. That's a fancy way of saying that the stored energy, when it's operational, is 10 or 20 times higher than the radiated energy at any one instant of time. It's like a flywheel. You're pumping energy into the flywheel, and the energy bounces back and forth. Turns out that radiating a signal is hard. As such, that signal has to bounce back and forth between the ends of your antenna something like 10 or 20 times before it finally goes out into space. Or you could say 5% of it goes out on each bounce. There's various ways of looking at it. So as long as the structure is resonated, and by structure I mean the antenna, the feed line, and the antenna matching box, the antenna tuner, that combination is what you're resonating. the antenna itself could be a random length of wire. So the fact that your fan dipole has the lowest frequency version of it, the lowest portion of it, the 40 meter, not at right angles to all the rest. I mean, when you're feeding 40 meter signal in there, the signal doesn't see the 20, the 15, and the 10, because they're representing an extremely high reactance. That really means high impedance. They're in almost an open circuit compared to the 40 meter thing. So I know you were led to believe, you're feeling uncomfortable, the fact that the fan dipole doesn't have all of the dipoles in the same plane. One of them is outer plane. Well, they're completely separate structures. Even though you fed them all together in the center, electronically, they're thoroughly independent structures, depending on what frequency you're feeding into the whole system. So you can get away with murder. And I'm trying to remember now, Mel, K2KEY, he had all kinds of crazy zigzags and parabolic bends and whatever of his vertically polarized dipole that was strung in the middle of his
repeater. Repeater. Cancel.
This quasi-vertical antenna was strung in the middle of this pine tree antenna that was in his front yard, where the upper half of the dipole was truly vertical, the bottom half curved over in kind of a parabolic shape, and he got extremely high performance out of that antenna. So you'd be amazed what murder you can get away with here, Lewis. And just because all the books don't show it that way doesn't mean you're forced to do it exactly the way the picture is in the book. You've got a lot of free reign here, as you can tell. And as you make these variations and try it, and at first it doesn't work or it works like a charm, again, please come back and let us know of your successes, your failures. Tell us the story, as you know, Lewis. And therefore, by the way, you're listed as living in Ilsford, Maine. I suspect you're really in Connecticut, and that's one of your residences. Is that true, Lewis? W2, Zebra Echo November, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm actually in Brooklyn right now, Dick, but I'm heading up to Maine in the end of April, and I'll be there for about 5 or 6 months. But what you said is basically what I thought, but I wasn't 100% sure, and I just wanted to confirm it. And I have another quick question regarding the antenna placement, if you got time.
We're on the subject of antennas. Please proceed, Lewis.
Great. So right now I have it up against a concrete wall, which is a building next to the roof. How much better off? I know I'll be better off if the antenna is just in space and not next to anything physical. How much better off, say, I run it diagonally so it's not against the cement wall? Will I be much better off? And the reason I ask is because it's less obvious to neighbors who might have an issue with it if it's up against the concrete wall. It just looks like another wire running against the wall. But obviously, if I run it in the air across the space, it's going to be a little more noticeable. I just was curious as to if you could advise generally how much better performance I might get by running it in space versus directly against a concrete wall.
Yeah, that's a fairly tough question, Lou. I'll tell you the good news, the bad news, and the in-between news if I can. The word concrete, there's a zillion different things that are called concrete. It could be cinder block wall with some coating of concrete on the outside, stucco-like. It could really be wire-lasting reinforced concrete. It could be concrete that's got a lot of moisture in it, which would make it quite a bit more lossy, or it could be very cinder block, air-filled, dry material, which is almost an open circuit. The concrete that you pour for a floor of a, say for instance, a warehouse, tends to have a dielectric constant of 6, which is quite high. And for an antenna laid flat against that concrete floor, not counting the wire lapping if it was there, the wire reinforcing, the rebars, if they're not there, just living with a dielectric constant of 6 up against your antenna would require a significant amount of retuning. And then when you did that, would you get some extra loss? Without a doubt, you're going to get some extra loss. Now, if the extra loss is 1 dB, a sixth of an S unit, nobody would know it. The presence of the concrete is going to change the tuning of the antenna a whole lot, but there's ways you can readjust the length of the antenna and force it back into resonance, or if your antenna tuner If your antenna tuner has a whole lot of dynamic range to it, you can bring everything back to normal again. I would give it a try. I think there's a 50-50 chance you're going to be getting a significant amount of loss from the concrete. There's a 50-50 chance that the amount of loss is not very significant. And if some night you string a second antenna away from the concrete and compare the two performances and then decide which one you're going to use, that's another way to go. Wire-like antennas tend to be fairly inexpensive. Therefore, there's nothing stopping you of putting up one that favors the north-south direction, putting up another one that favors the east-west direction, putting up one that favors vertical polarization as opposed to horizontal polarization. So, and you could put them up temporarily, maybe string it at nighttime, just to see how much better it could be if it's away from the concrete wall. And if it's not that much better, then you don't leave it up, the neighbor doesn't see it. So there's a whole series of experiments. You can tell we're giving you some homework here. Lewis. Yeah. We're giving you some homework here, Lou. And as you come back with the answers on this, we'd like to know what you find. Back to you for a final, Lou. W2ZEN, K2RIW.
WN4YY with a question, checking in late.
KC2ZUM with a question, checking in late.
Okay, RYY and ZUM recognized. Back to you, Lewis.
W2ZN. Thank you, Dick. Yeah, that's great information. I knew you were going to go the route of, having me experiment with it, and I'm definitely planning to do that, but I was curious if it was, like, going to be something minimal or going to be something potentially much more efficient if it was run a different way. So, yeah, testing, obviously, and getting hard numbers is the best way to do it, so I appreciate that information. Back to you. Thank you.
Very fine. Now, for those who signed in the beginning, I forgot to mention it during my monologue, but we try very hard to give people at least brief answers during the first hour to hour and a quarter, let's say. Then we go over to Paul, WS2N, who's got a space report, and John, KC2WGB, who has the mailbag for the newer amateurs, and we try to answer those questions. So for people who sign in later, we're going to try to squeeze you in before that, and if not, you might be delayed until after those two functions, depending on how the timing goes. Jim was the next person on our list who signed in at the beginning. KD2BHY, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Jim, with your real question.
All right. Hi, Dick. I have a microphone for my HF rig, and on the connector to the microphone to the radio, there are two pins, and there are two pins in the radio. Now, what Rich told me when he gave me the mic, thank you, Rich, is that the pins are switched, as in they are opposite pins, as in I would have to switch them in order for the microphone to work correctly. Now, is there any way I could get an adapter for that, or will I have to switch it myself?
For the guys who have been fairly experienced with electronics, opening up the screws that hold the connector together, unsoldering the wire, switching the wires and resoldering them, for us with that experience, that's relatively easy. For a person brand new to electronics who maybe doesn't own a soldering iron, hasn't done soldering, that is a bit of a pain. Although it's a bit of a learning curve. But not to worry. If at first you don't solder it too skillfully, you end up with a cold solder joint, you got to go back and do it again, or you do a little bit too much heating and you burn away the plastic insulation on the end of the wire, have to cut it back a little bit further and do it again. These are all minor problems. Go ahead and do it. I do strongly recommend you unsolder those leads and do the switch. The reason we're talking about this switch, let me drop, is that to my knowledge, most two-wire microphones really has a shielded lead, a kind of a coaxial cable-like thing going to the microphone element, and the outer shield wants to be grounded to the chassis of the radio. That's a very specific pin on the front panel, and the other hot wire is the center conductor. If you switch the two, you're going to end up with all of the shielding being hot and the center conductor being cold. Therefore, there's a higher probability you're going to get feedback and squealing and noise pickup and whatever. And maybe even the microphone itself, if it happened to be something like a D104 mic, which got a metal case to it, in that particular case, you'd get a hum pickup in your audio when you touch the metal case of that particular microphone. So there's a whole lot of reason to get that wiring correct. I do recommend you do the resoldering. To build yourself an adapter would be equally as difficult a soldering job. To buy the right male and the right female connector, connect them together to act as an adapter. The chances of you being able to find the adapter, I think, is kind of slim. Let's see what John's got to say about this. What if you run into this problem, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the second half.
This is DPG also, the comment.
Yes, Dick, I've run into the problem a couple of times where I didn't want to modify the mic. So what I did was I bought a mic extension cable and cut the cable and made the switch that way. It was for a temporary use. That'll get them out of the woods and relatively inexpensive. Radio Shack probably has it.
Now let's go a little bit slow here, John. Assuming now I had in my hand a mic extension cable, and now I plug his microphone, which its coil cord is, let me pick the number, 3 feet long. I now plug it into the mic extension, and assume now that I've got the mic extension cable wired correctly, so that I'm not modifying the connector. And yes, the mic extension cable is now properly wired, and it goes to the front panel of the radio. But still, the external world still has 3 feet of microphone cable that's wired backwards, and the shield is now hot on that particular lead. Although it'll work, I think it's less than ideal, and less that I've misunderstood you. On top of that, to modify his microphone connector is no big deal. I mean, that's so easy to reconnect downrange. I mean, in the case of digging into a radio and making major modification and violating the warranty and whatever and changing the resale value, yeah, some people are reluctant to do that. But on a simple microphone, rewiring the connector, I don't think we should have a reluctance to do that. So, as you can tell, I'm worried that you still have some external, exposed, unshielded wiring, even with that mic extension cable. Maybe I misunderstood what you're saying. But back to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, it was a two-conductor shielded wire, and all I did was snip it open and reverse those two center conductors, and that solved my problem. I don't know if that's exactly his issue, and I had no hum, no buzz, and the shielding worked fine because I didn't cut the shielding. So that's a quick fix. It worked for me. I don't know exactly what his situation is, but something to think about, and I agree with you. Soldering the connector is relatively simple. He should be able to do that. I'm sure there's somebody out there giving a hand.
This is DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, we heard you, Hal. And even if he feels unfamiliar with soldering and wants to go through the learning curve to walk that over to Andy's house and have Andy, among other people, modify the connector to him is a very easy way to go. Andy to B2CDL. So when you've had switched wiring on microphone plugs, wonder how you've handled that one, Hal. K6 Delta Papa Zulu, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right.
K2RIW in the TechNet, K6DP says. Well, first of all, we don't know if he's using that microphone for another radio also. So my suggestion is you can get the plugs to make a little adapter. That way he's not going to really disrupt the integrity of what he has. He can still get the experience of soldering and making up a very small little adapter from one plug to the other. That's my suggestion, Dick. Go ahead.
What you just heard are the words of a man who probably has 50 radios in his house, and therefore his particular microphone, in theory, could be used on some of the 49 other radios, and he worries about which connector he's got on his particular microphone. Now let's put ourselves into Jim's shoes, Hal. He has one single HF radio of slightly older vintage design, one single microphone of older vintage design, and the two have a degree of incompatibility. And does he really worry about whether or not that mic can be plugged into a whole lot of other radios? I don't think Jim gives a darn about that. That's my opinion. And so should he buy a pair of connectors? And by the way, just finding those old-fashioned connectors with two pins, they might not be in the bubble packs of Radio Shack of a male and a female side-by-side where you can connect the pair as an adapter. I think finding the right connectors could be a bit of a pain. I think he's way ahead of the game to modify the connector he's got, take it apart and modify it. If at worst it doesn't work, it's not going to catch on fire, it's not going to do anything bad, and he can either try again or walk it over to Andy's house. So there's a lot of people that'll fix it for you if it doesn't work at first on this situation as you see it, Jim. So I'm back to you, Jim, in case you've got any other further questions. Drag your feet a little bit in case someone else has got a suggestion on this one. KD2BHY with a little bit of a delay to take it. K2RIW the TechNet.
Earth it in the radio.
Go ahead, Jim.
All right. Thank you very much for the knowledge, and I'll definitely try soldering it. I do have a soldering gun, but it doesn't work. So I'll pick up another one. And I did, I have a story here. I ran to Radio Shack and got myself, I just kind of picked up a mic, some random mic, and there was and it only fit into the headphone jack. So I plugged it into the headphone jack and I could hear the radio through a microphone. So I returned that mic.
Jim, you can't use a soldering gun. You have to use a soldering pencil. This is Vito, WA2PJF.
Yeah, that's WA2 Pilot Jet Fighters, BJF, and you're absolutely right, Vito. A soldering gun tends to have a very large tip on it, Jim. The wiring inside of that connector is fairly small. The pins are fairly close together. And so at Radio Shack, you will see some very small soldering irons for only a couple of dollars. We're talking about an old-fashioned soldering iron that's got a round copper tip that's about an eighth of an inch in diameter and about a half an inch long. And even in that case, you might want to file that tip to a sharper point so that you can more easily get in between the pins that are fairly close together on the connector. So even if your soldering gun was working, it would take a lot of skill to be able to force that into the right position. You're way ahead of the game with a small soldering iron, and they're not very expensive at a Radio Shack. So let us know how that turns out, Jim, and that's not a showstopper. And it's a very educational process, as you can tell. Okay, the next person on the question on the list was Wes, and to it.
First in the radio.
And so, Wes, hope you've got a fairly brief question for this portion of the net. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yes, I do. Actually, it's a matter for entertainment. It's not going to take long. I was amazed by some factors related to ham radio community. First, I'm going to give you a short statement, quote, we live in energy world, we can measure energy at absolute zero minus 273 Celsius. The source of energy is that the mosquito will not bite and will not slap. At 15 degrees, a mosquito lives for 6 months, but is sluggish that you cannot slap her easy. At 27 degrees in Ormond Beach, Florida, she lives only about 2 weeks, but is so fast that you cannot slap her. And the technology that was utilized for that subject was about 30 different instruments, starting from World War II, and the techniques like Doppler detection devices, ultrasonic fields, radio proximity devices, photography, Bostrom motion, and others, measurement, counting, and display devices, controlled radiation fields, and so on. And all of this was done in 1966 by group amateurs that were proud of them promoting the science in New York, in here, in Radio Club of America. Let me drop. Okay, it looks like it cannot drop. From people that were responsible for it, I have sent you the link, so you can look at that. And I also sent that link to Bernie's family. Mosquito Metrology and Communication.
Repeater, time out.
I think you're reporting to us an article which I believe you sent out after 7 o'clock tonight. I didn't get a chance to view that one. And I think you're saying it's on the subject of the research radio amateurs were doing as to the lifespan and how to repel, I presume, mosquitoes in Florida, if I understand correctly.
Not only in Florida, it was done in New York, but the magnitude of that and the publications and the proceedings of that, also the system calibrations and operation methods, energy measurement, energy of the bite, energy of the wings. In 1966, mosquito duty cycles, and also the graph spectrograms of mosquito calls, and this is done all in New York, the ham radio amateurs. Number of scientists like Dr. Henrik Puschert and plenty of others were participating in it, and Carnegie International Center was participating in it on February 24th.
So what I think Wes is confirming is that, in my opinion, a true ham radio operator, in many cases, has a scientist inside trying to get out, and because they happen to be involved in wireless technology, they usually are worried about how well a transmission line works, an antenna works, a transmitter works, a receiver, propagation, and so on, in various modes of modulation and demodulation. But some of the ham radio operators branch far and wide into other subjects, and sometimes they use ham radio as a way of augmenting those other researchers. Like, I know that a fair amount of radio frequency biohazard research has taken place by which a person was using a radio signal to expose cells of in a petri dish that came from an animal, a plant, and the actual radio signal that they were exposing these cells to was either a 10 gigahertz what they call that gunplexer, in other words, it's a kind of a feed horn with a gun diode oscillator acting as the transmitter, and there's ways you can measure how much radio signal coming out of that, and you expose those cells to it. There are other ham radio operators who have used even their 20-meter rig or their 6-meter rig as a transmitter to do radio frequency biohazard experiments. So there's an amazing number of people who tie ham radio into the science of either their interest or their occupation of other kinds of measurement. That's part of what I think you're indicating here, Wes. Now, let me go on to the next person, which was John. John, we're going to go to your mailbag a little bit earlier tonight than normal, which we should be doing in order to... wait a minute now. We do have time for at least one more person with questions. Let's go over to Joe from HRYY. Joe, I haven't heard from you in a long time, and what would you like to talk about tonight? KQRIW in the deck net.
Dick, you copy TJF?
A TJF, I'm hearing you very well, sir.
You may mention that, I'm sorry, I do apologize. Quick, very quick question. What was that magazine you had made mention about the time?
Into XGN. That article was published in 1966, and the website was sent to bernie.huntfamily.com, and the website is www.jumpet.info. Jumpet will be jumpet.info/wireless/RCA/1966-06PDF. And what is unfortunate is that we live right now in your ham radio colleagues. Some of them are silent keys. Most of them are very old. And those people dedicate themselves with the tremendous group and the scientific experiment and to exist.
Mr. TJF, I think you were asking about the article on the subject of Titanic. Is that true? TJF, go right ahead. Give me your full call letters.
TJF, Vito and Bayshore. Yes, the information on the Titanic, please.
Very fine, Vito, yeah. The two articles about the radio operation on the Titanic in 1912 are both in the April issue of QST magazine, which maybe you haven't gotten it yet, Vito. When you get your April issue, there's two separate articles telling you what Mr. Phillips did. He's the main radio operator, and a very fascinating story about the way radio operators, how many of them there were, how many hours they were on duty, and the Carpathia, for instance, would not have known about the disaster of the Titanic if that particular radio operator hadn't gone beyond his normal work shift and was doing listening. The Californian, which was only 20 miles away, had shut down his radio for the night and therefore didn't know that a disaster was taking place. Carpathia was 50 miles away, but that radio operator went beyond his normal work period. He went back to the radio room when he was supposed to be going to bed. He decided to do a little bit more listening, and he suddenly heard somebody sending an emergency message at 15 words a minute at 1912. That was extremely fast. An excited guy sending a CQD SOS, which CQD means in distress, and SOS was just becoming known. And lucky for him, they knew the latitude and longitude and said, hey, we're sinking, and that particular radio operator had to go through hell just to convince the people running the Carpathia to go pick them up. Fascinating story. So, April issue, QST magazine. Over to you, Vito, if that makes sense.
Yes, I'm very familiar with the whole thing, the Carpathia, the Californian. The Californian was blocked by ice. They were a little frantic about moving the ship. But at midnight, they would shut down the communication center aboard ship, and it was not necessary to operate after that hour. Yes, the Carpathia did come and saved about 750 survivors of the 25 or whatever that were on board. I have many books on the topic. That's my key thing. I'm very fascinated by the Titanic of April 15th of 1912. Very good. But okay, you did make mention where I can find this information, and I am very, very pleased that you have passed that along to me, and I will pursue that. God bless. You be safe. WA2PJF is clear.
Yeah, the best guess is 710 people were saved of the almost 2,000 that were on board. So an awful lot of, I think something like 1,500 people did die, and some of them very important people in that particular disaster. And Marconi Radio was an independent contractor supplying wireless. In other words, the radio operators on the ships at that time were not employees directly of the ship owner. They were subcontractors. They were employees of the Marconi Radio Company, which is subcontracting communication equipment and people, operators, to the ships. And so as a result of the Titanic disaster, new rules were written where there had to be a minimum of two radio operators on board. There had to be continuous listening 24 hours a day. There had to be a certain quality of radio equipment and whatever. Because picture if that particular guy on the Carpathia hadn't been listening on his off-duty hours, if that particular message hadn't been received, then the majority of even the 700 and some odd people who were possibly going to be saved, they would have been floating around for who knows how many days in cold water, and the chances of them surviving would have been very slim. So this was a real close shave, even for those people, as you can tell. Alrighty, Joe, WA2RYY, I think you had a question. K2RYW on the tech net. You got it, Joe.
Real quick.
Yes, I did. If people would let me transmit when you give turn over to me, it would be appreciated.
You got it, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay. Alright. I was listening to your subject earlier about talking about transmission lines and so forth, and I have a particular problem which I'd like to just get some clarification on. I was helping somebody work on a mobile installation several weeks ago, and they were having a problem with thing wouldn't radiate a signal very well. It was rather weak into nearby repeaters. So I took a signal level measurement at a distance away with a spectrum analyzer off an outside house antenna, or an outside antenna installation, okay? And I got a signal level of, say, about minus 70 dBm on the transfer frequency. You follow that so far?
You received a minus 70 dBm on an outdoor antenna into a spectrum analyzer while listening to the output of the signal that you were studying. Go ahead.
Okay, they took a bird watt meter, and then they put the bird watt meter on the radio inside, which is normally supposed to be about approximately 25, 30 watt radio, and they were getting about 3 watts reflected power, and they couldn't figure out why this thing wasn't radiated properly. It doesn't show like the antenna circuit is totally shot, but it's got some sort of reflected power to it. Didn't know exactly what it was. But they said, you know what, I don't have time to get into this thing totally, with you, and I had him change the antenna cable in the vehicle itself. Just take the antenna cable totally out and change the antenna cable. Now, without the vehicle physically moving where it was parked, he changed the antenna cable, put the same antenna cable back on the vehicle, transmitted with the radio, and now the signal went up to about minus 50, something like that, 50, 48, 50 dBm. So it increased like something almost 20 decibels or slightly more, sitting in the same physical spot. How would you explain that?
Well, what I was in the process of doing is figuring out what is the standing wave ratio of 3 watts reflected with 25 watts going forward, and it's an extremely good standing wave ratio, less than 2 to 1. So it should have worked like a charm. Now, one of the things I want you to repeat is what got changed. The watt meter, which was reading 3 watts reflected, but you didn't tell me what the forward was, and some kind of a change was changed, and now a new reading was taken instead of minus 70 dBm. So repeat, what change was made, what power reading was read on the bird watt meter, forward or reflected, and what reading that you saw. Back to you, Joe.
Forward reading was somewhere in the range of 25, 26 watts, something like that, with the accuracy of the bird watt meter, which seemed to be pretty much correct for the power level of mobile radio. There was about 3 watts or so indicated on the bird watt meter in the reflected mode. And then the antenna cable was changed. And when the new antenna cable was put in, it showed around the same forward wattage, but the reflected wattage was quite a bit lower, much, much lower, to where it was only like about a quarter watt or something like that reflected power. Back to you. And when that was done, that changed the radiated energy signal that was being picked up by me at a certain distance away, by a factor of almost 20 decibels or slightly more.
And you didn't say in which direction. Did the minus 70 become minus 50? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. You didn't tell me what was the nature of the old cable and what's the nature of the new cable. What was the old cable? What's the new cable, Joe?
Radio transmission cable is basically a form of RG58U in a typical mobile installation with a... I think in a Motorola NMO type of mount in the ceiling of the vehicle, the roof of the vehicle. They should be RG58 on a UHF frequency.
You didn't say, but I'm going to guess that there was RG58 to a mobile mount before, and you put in new RG58. The 3 watts reflected became quarter watt reflected, and the forward signal became 20 decibels stronger. Water in the cable would do all of that, Joe. Water in the cable, particularly if it was foam-filled cable, there's RG58 versions that are foam-filled, can become extremely lossy when you measure the input standing wave ratio of a water-filled cable, because the water is so absorptive, it's almost a dummy load, it can easily be attenuating your signal by 20 dB, giving you a little bit of reflection, because instead of it being 50 ohms, it's acting like 35 ohms, so to speak, because of the water. So, VisWar doesn't show it, conservation of energy doesn't reflect it, but that bad piece of cable that he took out, assuming he had good contact on both ends, it'd be fun to study that cable, put higher power into it, see how hot it gets, and with further inspection, I think you're going to find water in it, is my first guess. So lossy cable by way of water is one possible explanation, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, my question is, how come something like that did not show up with instrumentation where you're testing the forward power and reflected power? Wouldn't a section of the cable that was, say, lodged with water or even moisture across the cable across the center conductor, wouldn't that tend to show a much higher reflected power reading?
And not at all. Particularly at VHF frequencies, and I'm assuming this is VHF. Water is an extremely good dummy load. In fact, the very first piece of waveguide done by Mr. Southworth, he literally